the 20th of August, 1988, and we have with us Marie Best.
Stanton.
What am I saying? Best.
Yeah, we can call me Marie Best.
No, Marie Stanton.
S-T-A-N-T-O-N.
And you were born when and where?
I was born October 7th, 1952, in Washington, D.C.
Where? Oh, in D.C.
Mm-hmm.
And what's your permanent address?
5527 Burnside Drive, Rockville, Maryland.
Okay. I guess you know what to do. Just tell me about your childhood and what you think was important in your growing up and what happened and where you are today.
Half hour?
You have 90 minutes if you want.
Yeah.
So, just talk about whatever you want.
Okay. Hi, it's 11:15 at night, so I'll probably just talk about what's on my mind now, too. I'm one of a very large family, and we present a rather textbook case of addiction, I'd say, or alcoholism. Although I, as an individual, are very different than my brothers and sisters. One parent's an alcoholic. On that parent's side, all of his siblings were alcoholics, and probably his father. On my other parent's side, I had a cousin who's already dead from addiction, and two more that are on their way. In my own family, there's 11 of us, and half of us are addicted to something, chemical. The other half have what is called codependent problems or other sort of neurotic addictions with food or there's some gambling in the family. There's some obsession with money. And all these, this sounds terrible. I mean, we're talking about people that are pretty much otherwise wonderful human beings that as far as the real dark side of human nature, on a scale of 1 to 10, we don't dip in down below 5 as far as having any people in prison or acting very, very violent and I think that has left to do with my upbringing. I was brought up in a middle to upper class family and sent to private schools. And although that doesn't shield one from anything, it was very important in our family to appear normal and appear well, achieve great things. Like I said, we have 11 children. We all have college educations. And that I attribute to my father, who was not the actual disciplinarian day-to-day, my mother was, but he had a drive in him that exhibits in his children. And he pretty much was the one who was the authoritarian and the person you didn't mess with too much. I'd say in one way or the other, most of us are afraid, but I can only really talk about myself. I've had a fear of my father most of my life that has been greatly relieved for me since I've been clean and sober. And my last using date was January 8th, 1979. And so it's about 9.5 years now. And during that time, I've had the good fortune to mend some fences with my family and reestablish relationships that I lost with them as a result of working a 12-step program. Let me see, my first drink, I'd say for myself, I must add that in our family, we're Irish Catholic descent, and that doesn't mean you have to be an alcoholic, but it helps. There were stories that my parents and my aunts and uncles tell of their Irish people who, at one time it was fashionable to take the pledge. And those that were definitely alcoholics at the pledge just went crazy. Because as I understand it today, that's what happens to alcoholics and drug addicts that don't imbibe or use and don't have another way to do things. Because as I understand the nature of addiction is that one of the worst problems involved is what one thinks in one's head and how one feels. And if you have nothing to do or remedy that situation inside yourself, going crazy is probably the next step. In fact, that's what a lot of especially my drinking in my later years was. I think I was warding off nervous breakdowns or emotional collapses, whatever you want to call it, because I grew to see that if I drank or if I used something to manipulate my mood, it was much better than just being me. Because I had my first drink for myself, and I was going to say there was drinking in our family, so it was never taboo, was when I was about 13 and I was babysitting in someone else's house. And I remember this well because it was the first time I poured my own drink, and it was some kind of cordial or something, and I kind of kicked back over across the street where I was babysitting in this gorgeous house with crystal decanters and silverware and two-inch rugs, and I kicked back and had that little drink, and I was somewhere else. That made me feel like I belonged in that house, and it made me feel like other people appeared to be living. It made me feel like I was sophisticated, and I wasn't gangly or chubby or pudgy or didn't know enough, was embarrassed about myself and my body. Alcohol did a lot of things for me. It wasn't until later years that I started using drugs. But that first memory that I had of having that drink all alone and going somewhere else in my head, I think was very important. I mean, I had little sips off of people's drinks around the house and so forth, but because cocktail hour in our house was ritual. The highballs were done, and my parents would always have a drink at night, always. My mother's not an alcoholic, so she would never have more than one, but my father was big on ceremony. No matter, this always cracked me up because this man, every time I saw him pour a drink in that house where we lived when I was a child, he poured drinks out in the jigger first and then put in the glass, and I never did that. And I later on see that was his attempt of being good. You know, he thought that how could he be an alcoholic if he measured his drinks, you know, and he didn't like slug it out of the bottle. But I've learned alcoholics do a lot of funny things to hide the fact from themselves that they're alcoholics. Anyway, I went to a private high school, and like I said, it was very, very important for me to fit in. My childhood, to give an overview, I could say I was one of the crowd. I was never, I was one that didn't stand out. I never wanted to embarrass my family. I never wanted anybody to find out things I did, so keeping secrets was big for me. We often told on each other. So it was easy for me to lie and not feel guilty about it, rather feel it was necessary. And there was also something that was going on that I've learned in later years. In fact, most of this I've learned since I've been clean and sober, because I didn't have the knowledge then, is that when you grow up around a group of people that are drinking, they often deny reality. And as long as the role models I had were denying reality, I found it easy to do that too. I believe I was an alcoholic from the start, and I'm not sure, I have no idea, or I don't even care anymore whether it's genetic or psychological or something you caught from your neighbor. I don't care anymore. That is not important to me. It was at one time, but I think I was still struggling with was I an alcoholic or not, because all those facts mean nothing when you hear my story. Because the fact is that I drank uncontrollably and as much as I could for as long as I could. And it doesn't matter to me whether I have a different gene or I had a screwed up family or whatever. It's sort of after the fact. We like to dicker about these things, but to me it's not important, really. Like I said, I went to a private school, and it was the kind of school where there was only about 50 people in my class, and anything you did, someone heard about it, and it was around the school the next day, so I had to be very careful about what I did in public. And so I controlled myself pretty much. That school controlled me, or my parents controlled me, or whatever, until I was about 17. I really wasn't one of these wild kids in high school. I mean, I was about as wild as you could get for that situation. I broke the rules, the little rules. We weren't supposed to smoke on campus. We'd find a tree and climb it and smoke. But these, as compared to what other kids were doing at the age of 16, you know, ending up in delinquent homes, I wasn't into that. But I was into breaking rules whenever I could. And, you know, not that feeling of being different, somehow I could get away with things. Disobedience. And it's disobedience, no matter what you call it. In other words, if there was a rule, I would disobey it and think nothing of it. And I think that was the difference for me at the time. To enable the way I was feeling and my compulsion, I would have no limits, no boundaries as to what I would or wouldn't do. Now, that wasn't always how I felt. I knew at times I was doing something wrong. I knew it, and I did it anyway. And as I understand it, without a spiritual life, that's the way one can live. That's the way I lived. I had God pretty much in my home, in my school. It was part of the culture. It was something that I never questioned, really. All of a sudden, I just didn't feel too hot on it. I was about the age of 15 at that time. When all the, you know, I had what was pretty high restrictions, pretty high morals taught to me. Don't ever do this or don't do that. And so really doing anything that was pleasurable was probably sinful too. And I've come to understand that differently today. But I think I had a heavy sense of guilt that I had to fight all the time. And I think that this is where I begin to shove out of my head or suppress or repress or whatever you want to call it. A lot of things that I did, I denied these things. I denied them because I didn't want to own up to them. I didn't want to face myself or face reality. Whether it was stealing or having sex with someone or lying or doing things to hurt people and calling it something else. Doing things for people's own good that was painful and calling it something else. Meaning that I thought I was noble doing some of these things, and they were just plain hurtful to other people. My consciousness was very limited. Even though I am pretty developed intellectually, none of it got below my neck. I could give you any information, any time, on any sort of thing that I knew something about, but I never integrated it into my being and my soul or my way of life. It was sort of superficial information I was going to use at some later date. And that was a pattern that I followed throughout my life before I recovered, is that I would always seem to be storing away things for some other time and never either enjoying them, integrating them, really experiencing them. And as I understand it, when you drink and take drugs, you can't really experience much but your own high or your own chemical effect. But at the time, you see, I thought I was very sophisticated. It's very important for me to be different than my family was. Even though I was very much attached to them, I think somewhere in me, because I knew that I was not nurtured or cared for directly in my family. My father was a physician. He was hardly ever home. When he was drinking or doing something else. My mother was quite busy because there were many of us. And I never had hands-on, or not much of it, as I understand it today. Not a lot of one-to-one contact except with my other siblings. So I had an older sister that represented an authority to me. And I really had no other strong brother, so I think that's why my father, in my head at least, remained the authority. Through high school, we would drink on the weekends. I started skipping school only in my senior year. I started wondering what it was like on the outside. I'd always been an artist since I was young, and it was never encouraged in me. In fact, when I would bring sketch pads home from the first art class I took, my mother told me not to let my brothers and sisters see them, especially if there's any nudes in them. And it was something that people would pat me on the head and want to see my pictures, but it was never encouraged to really become an insightful, intuitive individual. Anything that was not out of the norm or controlled by my environment wasn't encouraged. And that sounds a little, well, that sounds, but maybe I can say it a better way. I think the egos in my family and environment were so strong that if you did something because you were selfish, it was wrong. if you did something that was kooky or weird, it was wrong. If you didn't do something that was completely clean or socially acceptable, it was wrong. You know, it was this kind of idea. Now, no one ever smacked me across the face and said, you know, what you're doing is wrong. But it was always implied. It was by the things that weren't said, by the attention that wasn't given, and by the looks. So as a result of that, I never took the responsibility. Maybe it wasn't a direct result of that, because I had such low self-esteem, I never thought really what I said or what I did was that important anyway. But like I say, at the end of high school, I had to make choices on what I was going to do, so I did the socially acceptable thing. I went to interior design school, and it was the first time I can ever remember being seriously depressed, because I wasn't the cute girl anymore. I wasn't going to high school proms anymore, and which, of course, I got drunk at, and my mother wasn't told. I mean, everything was hidden, everything was hush-hushed, you know, if there was an incident or a scene. But I went to this design school, and when I got there, that wasn't quite there either. I had started gaining a lot of weight, and that's when I first got in touch with the fact I had an eating disorder. Like I say, I wasn't, you know, I had a hard time passing from adolescence. I never really did the things that adolescents, as I understand it today, normally do, separate from their family, go out and do their own thing, want to go away to school. I didn't want to go away to school. So at one, I was a dichotomy, and one fact, I was very tied to my family, and then I didn't want to be anything like them. I didn't want to be a homebody. I wanted to be sophisticated. I went out to bars downtown. I mean, this, you know, if I had, my mother wasn't aware of this. If she was, she would have never approved of that. I like wearing evening clothes. I like going to cocktail parties. I like getting in with fast crowds. At the same time, I was deeply resentful because the first time I went to art school, which was a couple years later, I found that interior design really wasn't it for me. I really wanted to paint, and I had a lot of talent inside me I didn't know. When I went to art school, I was deeply resentful because the people that I went to school with had been developing their talents for a while. I felt stupid. I felt insecure and inferior, and pretty much because I wasn't that developed. I wasn't that much of a grown up, and I was still very much of a little girl inside. About the age of 19, I began drinking regularly, and using, marijuana and speed. That was the first time I went on a diet of any great consequence. I mean, I lost about 40 pounds at that time. And I thought it was the best thing I ever did, you know. I met my future husband at that time. He just was crazy for me. I had sex for the first time. I was drunk when I had sex for the first time. And I was drunk pretty much every time I had sex thereafter. Not stumbling drunk all the time, but at least influenced. Put at ease. It was weird because I felt like I was very much in love with this man. With him, I wasn't drunk all the time, but I very much was afraid of my body image. I was anxious about the way somebody would or wouldn't reject me. I always had that underlying feeling, not especially with sex, but anywhere when I was outside of myself, I always had that feeling of unease or upset just a little bit, something like maybe my motor was turned up too high. I think that's why I liked moving with a fast crowd. I was kind of a hyper type, you know. But there was also another side of me that was very much interested in the arts, in dance. I had taken violin lessons when I was a child. And all of that, I would give that away to be accepted or be in a crowd of people. I mean, it became more important to me to be sitting in the bar getting attention than it would be at home developing myself. And this is one of the real tragedies for me of addiction of any type, is that the God-given things that we have or the ability we have to love and care for people are all taken away. The ability we have to appreciate nature, to be in our environments or just aware and intelligent and searching for knowledge is gone. The only time that's there is when you're competing with somebody. But anyway, like I said, I know this now. I didn't know too much then. Anyway, I got older. I got worse. I started working in a bar. I started hanging around with bar people. So I was an artist by day and a bar person by night. On vacation, I worked full-time as a bartender. And for a little Catholic schoolgirl who used to wear plaid skirts, this is kind of a different kind of life for me. I thought it was, this is really it. I thought it was hot. I was never real, real big on doing illegal drugs as far as what I term narcotics, but I was real big on smoking pot and taking speed anytime I could get my hands on it. And it occurred to me later that one of the reasons for this is that physically, when you drink a lot, it's real hard to motivate yourself. And speed did that for me, so I was getting up during the day and drinking myself down at night and doing, any different sort of treated grass. The more it put me out, the better I liked it. When I mean out, I mean somewhere out of my head. Not necessarily out cold, but that feeling of being in some kind of fantasy or being just a lot more than I was. I think alcohol and drugs directly affected and distorted my ego. I think that's probably one of the pits of the disease. I mean, the cause of the disease is that it's an ego thing. Always hiding that low image of I had of myself, or that inadequacy that I fed on, and a personal hell began to build in me. And I personally think that a personal hell is very important to an addict, because if you don't have a personal hell, you see, you have no reason to take all those drugs. And whether that's psychological or biological or physiological, I'm not sure. But I know that what was in my head was far different than the way I was acting. I always had an inbred sense of tragedy. I appealed to the underdog a lot. I just had this thing about justice that it seemed like nobody ever got justice. I mean, I would sit around and think about these things, you know. I was very much into music, and I would compulsively buy records that spoke to me. Really into myself, really into what I thought, what I felt. But, of course, that was my secret, because I never communicated that information to anybody else. After a struggle, I went to art school full-time here in Washington. And I would produce really good work and then somehow blow it. Like at the end of my second, the semester of my second year, the first semester, I compulsively married a man, this man that I fell in love with. And it was a sense of I had to have him. I couldn't bear to be rejected by this man. He had dated other women, and we had a very stormy relationship. We never sat down and realistically talked about marriage. We just wanted each other. It was one of those things. So I quit school. I quit the best thing that I ever had to marry this guy, because that's what he wanted. And, of course, that led me to a lot of disillusionment and resentment at him in the long run, because I returned to school a few years later. By that time, I was full-blown into an eating disorder, anorexia foremost, and mostly what I did was I tried to do things to keep people quiet and keep them off my back, and I drank a lot. I went out and party with my friends, and I got drank. I drank often, and I embarrassed myself, and I got drunk a lot. And my husband, as far as I know, was not an alcoholic, though his mother was. And they told me in treatment that sort of coupling up was in the stars, that it was not unusual for the son of an alcoholic to marry an alcoholic. It all began to make sense to me a few years into recovery, and I put it all together, that we fed on each other. All the time, I'm losing a little bit here and there contact with my family. Didn't want to tell them how depressed I was. Didn't want to tell them how shitty my life was. My life looked great. We owned property. I had a good job here and there. I never got fired from a job because I never showed up drunk. The times that I did, I was working by myself, so the owners didn't find out. And at one point, I was trying desperately not to drink. In the early 70s, by the time I was 22, I was a full-blown alcoholic and drug addict. And see, I had gotten a message, you see, that the man I was living with didn't like this. I had gotten that message real clear. And so what I would do around him, I would smoke dope, because he didn't see that marked falling down personality change in me was okay with him if I smoked dope or if I had drugs. And he was the type, if I had anything to drink, he could tell. So it became not only a struggle in myself, but a struggle with him, a struggle with my parents. I'd had numerous car accidents in my drinking, and some bodily injury, meaning I had broken some bones. I had, you know, an eye injury one night in some kind of confused state. In other words, there were things that if someone got drunk and that kind of crap happened to them, they probably wouldn't get drunk again. But not me. I'd do it again. And then I was one of these that if somebody was doing some drugs and they looked like they were pretty fucked up, I'd say, well, why don't you give me some of that, you know? Wouldn't ask what it was, where they get it, who bought it, can it kill me? I'd do it. By the time I went to treatment, I weighed about 82 pounds. I had been in a serious near-fatal car accident, the result of which I'm permanently disabled. 7 years into my recovery, I wore a cast on my arm as a result of that. And that night, I was in a hurry to get to a bar. I had gone to the psychiatrist that day, after I drank about four beers, to go tell him what my problem was. And this man was a good man. He was recovering himself, and he had been telling me for weeks I was an alcoholic, you know. And I went in there to talk about how bad I felt. I didn't fool him for a minute. I had had a couple of interventions done on me. I had been living on and off in my car, on and off in my husband's house, and on and off with my parents by that time. And I was everybody's problem. I was unemployable. The last person I worked for, I worked in my father's office, and he fired me because I showed up one morning drunk. He was the only person who ever told me not to come to work. I thought, of all people, how embarrassing, my own father. The thing was funny about him, because he went to AA about a year before that, and he had stopped drinking. And it was the first time in my whole life I ever saw him stop drinking. So I had been going to meetings for about 6 months, but I wasn't serious about the whole thing. At that point, as I understand it today, I mean, I was physically close to death a lot of times. I mean, as far as overdose and jaundice and liver disease. I spent a lot of time drinking by myself for the last few years because I could no longer go out or drive or hope to drink in public and get home safely by myself. My husband wouldn't drink with me at all. And he was constantly watching me when we were with friends or somewhere because I was uncontrollable. I was impulsive. I would show up drunk places. And he would swear that I didn't, you know, how could I get to it? He locked the liquor up. He did all those kind of things. So at one point in my life when I had everything to live for, I continued to drink. And it was at the end of this where I had really nothing going for me. I mean, I was really fucked up. I was physically very, very ill. I was psychologically almost, I was clinically insane, between alcoholism, drug addiction, and anorexia. I was a social outcast, and I was thrown out of my family pretty much. I was like the black sheep there. You know, this promising, young, talented girl that always got straight A's in high school and you know, was beautiful at times. I mean, I hate to say that about myself because that's what I was told before I had really messed myself up. That at the time I should have been on the top of the world. I felt terrible. And there's a whole lot more I can say about that, but I can't say it in half an hour. And I think it's a conglomeration of things. I think it is an accumulation of a lifetime of poor perception of myself and of reality, especially not just of myself. I don't think this is all just one quick answer. But I do know this, is that I never had that feeling of going outside of myself for help. I never really, I mean, I gave lip service to it, but I never really broke out. I mean, I was very tough inside. I felt secure because my brothers raised me. I had six brothers. I thought, you know, I know everything. I was very tough, kind of streetwise for going to private schools. I like bad boys. I like guys that, especially their intellectual level was lower than mine. You know, the fast cars and guns and stuff. I had gotten pulled over by cops. I had I was in Puerto Rico one time with a friend of mine. We went down there on one of our fun runs, and got arrested on the beach with no pants on coming out of a blackout. I mean, it was like, it got so unpredictable for me, but I would drink again or take drugs again. And I was caught that time with some drug dealer who was on exile from New York. I mean, the cops were watching him. I never used my brain. But it was that kind of thing. I got very loose and very dangerous. You know, even stuff that probably didn't mean much to anybody, but I could just imagine if someone had seen me doing something. I was coming up from work one night. I was working in Georgetown in a shop. Apparently, I closed the shop up and had a few drinks and took a nap. I woke up at 4 o'clock in the morning on the floor of the shop, and I can remember that because I was walking up M Street to my car, and I just remember coming out of a blackout then, and my blouse was unbuttoned. I was walking up there with an open blouse, still half drunk, dazed. And I mean, anything could have happened to me. There's many times I've looked back, and I like to use the phrase the grace of God, but there were many times that I looked back, and I was so close to trouble. And I was taken to the emergency room a couple times in blackouts, revived. I had, like I say, several car accidents. When I had the last accident I had, I was hit by a car. I was walking. And that almost killed me. I wish I could say that after that accident I wised up, but it was 2 months before I went to treatment. I felt like everything was gone, absolutely everything. I was left-handed, and as an artist, it was my left arm that I shattered. So the only thing that I could think was, I had suicidal thoughts many times, but what struck me then is that the only real thing that I felt that I owned, which was my ability to draw, was gone. For some reason, the family didn't matter at that point, the husband didn't matter, no money didn't matter, unemployable didn't matter, but the shame came to me when I could not physically lift myself up to a sitting position and people had to be there, people had to aid me. It produced the most unbelievable amount of anxiety in me. And I started taking fistfuls of pills, narcotics, that they gave me for pain to deal with that. And more with that than the pain, although it was an incredibly painful situation. So I stayed pretty much knocked out of it past Christmas that year, and I didn't come to treatment until January. And I think what happened for me is that I got out of my environment for a month. I got out off the street. I couldn't run out and get drunk. And I was what they labeled a very poor candidate for impulse control. Very poor compulsion or self-discipline. So I took antabuse for the first year. It was easy for me somehow to knock the drugs off because I knew that the speed I had taken years before, I mean, it had made me crazy. So I was off the speed for a while. And the last time I had cocaine was earlier that year. So I wasn't withdrawn off all that. I did have to draw all this medication I was on and liquor. But I felt like I didn't have anything. And I think that's why people then that I saw, I mean, I had been seeing people for 6 or 9 months at meetings, and they really... I mean, I just didn't believe anything. I didn't believe anything in AA meetings or anything in different therapy groups I went to. And I had been 5 years trying to stop drinking and doing drugs. The first time I went was back in 1974 to an outpatient treatment facility. I'd gone to several different psychiatrists, and I got every explanation from it's your birth control pills to your father's an alcoholic and that's why you're fucked up. I had gotten every kind of stupid answer, as I call stupid today, because no one ever said, what about you? You're fucked up, you know? You're in bad shape, until that last shrink who put me into treatment. And I owe a debt of gratitude to him and my ex-husband, who is my ex-husband now, because without him, I couldn't have made it my first couple of years. He supported me financially. He was there at least for me coming in and out of the hospital when I was operated on medically. I had my arm put back together over the next 7 years. And it was a very difficult and a very enlightening struggle for me. I don't have a normal story where someone comes in and gets a job and gets the love of their life and just floats off, you know. I had a very disheartening experience, a very disillusioning experience, because I never really had to pay for any trouble I caused when I was out there. The trouble I paid for was when I was sober, because everything that I had done chased me right into my sobriety. My physical condition, I had to go into psychiatric treatment to deal with anorexia. Thank God I found a man who could deal with that. He knew that I was an alcoholic, primary alcoholic and primary anorexic. I mean, this man nursed me back. He got me back into school. I mean, he didn't do it, but the way he treated me, I was in good enough mental shape at that time that I could follow what he told me to do. Because he knew before I did what I needed. I had a great, great sponsor. Without a couple different people that were very strong to me in my early years, I could have never made it. I didn't know that I could go and get Social Security for being disabled. I mean, you know, stuff like that. I was advised financially. I had to leave my husband. I went and I was divorced my third year into recovery. I don't want to make it like he wanted me, because he didn't. And he had decided that long time ago, but he was just, I think, feeling sorry for me for the first few years. We didn't live together the second year. He left when I was 6 months clean. He couldn't take the medical situation I was in, and he just couldn't take me anymore, for real. And that turned out more to be a blessing than anything else. I didn't understand that at the time, because to me, I saw that as a loss from my addiction, which it was. I would kind of like to get around to what the most important thing is for me, because all this grim situation I came into recovery with slowly over the years got much better because of the work I did on me and the help that people gave me. But I don't think anyone in recovery gets anything unless they are the ones who, number one, want it and are willing to work for it. Because quite frankly, there have been some things I wanted and I didn't do the work and I didn't get them. or it took me longer to get them because I was trying to do something else. And I didn't want to go to the direct route. I didn't want to be honest. I didn't want to do the legwork. Or I couldn't, I thought. I was too scared. But the most important part of all this is that, you see, I wanted to kill myself, I thought, when I was ready. Kind of like, you know, okay, the world finally pissed me off enough I was going to do it. Now, when I was injured so severely and I didn't die, it struck me that maybe I wasn't going to choose. Maybe something else was in charge here, you know? And that idea probably came from a meeting, really. Because so much has come from meetings. Yeah, it came through my ears because I was sitting there, but the inspiration came from somewhere else, not inside of me. But the fear I had of that kind of bottom, it has aided me a lot in my recovery. It has kept me clean at times when there was no reason to be clean. I didn't have a compulsion necessarily, but the memory of repeating anything that remotely was like the life I was leading scared the hell out of me, because I have no question in my mind that I would go do that again. I know that chemicals in me are like floodgates. Man, everything would break open. But there was hope that was instilled in me and faith that I gained, mainly through experience. It wasn't because someone told me there was a God in heaven and he takes care of children and drunks, you know, like you hear. That's not how it came. It came through me, through positive experience of walking through fear, of having people I didn't even know help me, people that I would never in the farthest reaches of my mind ever associate with my family help me. It came from people I didn't know, essentially, and they had no motivation to help me, and they didn't want anything from me. And I think this is essential as far as a program of recovery is concerned. It is essential that I remain available for that, and that I speak, or I share, or I make phone calls, or I receive phone calls when I'm asked. It's very important. And I'm of the belief now that we're given many conditions in our lives, and it's up to us how do we respond to that. Meaning that it's my job to be the person I need to be, and that's the only way I can keep any sense of integrity. And I think, you know, integrity of oneself and feeling that I've done things in a proper way not, I mean, proper according to me with values, rather than conditions, is what keeps me with a zest for life and a meaning in life, and motivated. I had started my own business, and it kept me fair. It kept me out of the compulsive, money-hungry bit for a while. I've experienced many things in my sobriety. I've been deeply in love, and I've had my heart broken. I've been able to maintain long and satisfying friendships, and been able to get over a lot of emotional hurdles with my parents and family to enjoy family life. I'd had the same address for 9 years and phone number. I mean, to a recovering addict, this is a big deal. I recently moved and went under a bunch of upheaval again at almost 10 years, and it was a very strange experience to me, but I never lost that solid core of, I can't give up, now I'm going to be okay. And that is pretty much where I'm at now. I think I'm better with pictures than words. If I had to describe what filled up emptiness, I'm not quite sure of that all the time. I know that I'm not real tough anymore. I know that I've cried a lot, especially lately. I really wanted to be close to people, which is something I never wanted to do. I've gained, you know, an amount of trust that I never experienced before. And I've learned pretty much how to take care of myself in a way I never did. And I've seen recovery on all fronts. I'm healthy physically. I'm pretty healthy mentally. I can put a lot behind me. And it's all to the credit of the program and other people.